Good morning. May it please the court. I'm Roger Leishman. I'd like to reserve it says 11. I don't think you meant that. There you go. Reserve 3 minutes. Thanks. This appeal concerns the question of what was the legislature's intent when they passed the Brenda Hill whistleblower protection bill, which the part of it that is RCW 424-510. The easiest way to approach the case is to break into two questions, I think. The primary question and a smaller one. The primary question is the role of the vendor. Did the legislature intend to grant absolute immunity to paid commercial vendors hired by government agencies if their assignments involve communicating with their agency customer? And the short answer to that is no. There's a difference between reporting potential wrongdoing to the relevant agency and being paid to write a report. Those are two different things. The second question is that I can call the nexus question, and the court doesn't need to reach it if the first question should be dispositive. But the question is, what nexus does there have to be between the alleged whistleblower communication and the particular plaintiff's cause of action? Again, the short answer, the court provided it in the Dang versus Arrett case, which is, and I want to make sure I'm quoting it correctly, that the phrase based upon the communication in Section 520 means that the communication is, quote, the starting point or foundation of the claim, end quote, not something that was written 6 weeks after the disputed issues. But let me dive right into the I'm at an age where going back and forth with my glasses is very challenging. So, but all of you probably can relate to that. On the intent, let me suggest there's three very obvious sources of guidance on the intent. There's what the legislature, the Senate, the House, and the governor all said at the time in legislative history. And so, for example, I'd point you to what the governor said in his partial veto message, which is said that the bill came out of, quote, a specific factual situation. A citizen reported the violation of a tax law to the state agency. The agency took enforcement action, and the party who was alleged to have violated the law sued the citizen for slander and libel. So the law was passed so that citizens can feel secure in reporting possible violations of the law to regulatory agency, and then the agency can then verify the facts and take appropriate action. There's similar language in the House, the Senate. This is what they were dealing with.
Why do we even get to the intent, though? We've got a statute that's pretty easy to read, it looks like. It says a person who communicates a complaint or information to any branch or agency of the federal state government. Person. Information. It's pretty broad.
If you only look at those words, I mean, but that is the problem in this case, is if you only looked at those words and you gave each of them their broadest possible meaning, which is exactly what the trial court did, that's the road you go down. But then when you, as you march past the parade of horribles, you keep running into things that are obviously not what the court intended. For example, the Reed case, the Stephen Euster thing. Yes, the plain language of this would say you can't file a frivolous action suit. Or in the Segalin case, government's a person. So the courts have already recognized that we need to make some kind of limitation from the literal language. And so, but the second source of the information is in the 2002 amendment, which is the operative statute. It wasn't codified, but it's there in the RCW, and the language there again it says it's refers to petitioning the government for action of the First Amendment, and for the purpose of protecting, quote, advocacy to government.
What are you reading from there?
Well, it's in the RCW for Section 510. In the 2002 amendments, they didn't codify the provision that states the purpose of the amendment, but. I mean, if you go to the RCWs, it's there.
So it's in the session law as well.
It's there, but for whatever reason, they didn't codify it, unlike Section 500, which codified the original bill in 1989. But that's exactly what the Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court saw in the Coburn case, that by definition, as a matter of law, You can't pay a vendor to advocate to the government. In Washington, here, under our PDC regime, it's impossible to take taxpayer money and advocate to the government. That's lobbying. I cited one like RCW 42, 17A, 635.3. It's an example of that. So I mean, that's if we're talking about advocacy to government, it cannot be something the government is paying to talk to itself over. And then finally, in this section, the Section 500 has the same things. It's about the purpose of this to act as a deterrent to citizens who wish to report information. Wish to report. The word voluntary, it comes from the Latin word for acting because you wish to, not because you're coerced or paid for. There are lots of other examples of the distinction between voluntary and pay commercial things. For example, the Good Samaritan Statute, RCW 424-300, applies to people who without compensation or expectation of compensation. There's a statute regarding volunteers who assist nonprofits of the government, RCW 424-300. In contrast, there's a well-established body of law that says that information, commercial informational providers are subject to liability under very specific concerns.
Let me ask you this. Why, as a matter of policy, if we've got a complaint filed with an agency, an internal complaint, whether it's harassment or something else, why don't we want the agency to go out and get an independent investigator to make sure they investigate the facts and provide it back? That's a good thing.
We do. We want them to do it.
So let me follow through. Mm-hmm. If in your case the report had come out entirely favorable toward the plaintiff, toward you, and the employee of the agency had sued Ogden Murphy Wallace for the report, would that be a good suit?
Let me ask you, flip around and say, well, what if the employer were Microsoft? Why, as a policy matter, should Ogden Murphy, if they are hired by Microsoft, be subject to normal rules of negligent misrepresentation, the CPA, and all of that? But if they're hired by a government agency, suddenly they're magically immune. That is bad policy, fundamentally bad policy, and it's not supported by the stated intent of the law, the way it's been used. I have lots more to say about the Nexus thing, but I'll save it for rebuttal and return. Thank you.
May it please the Court, Claire Martirosian for Ogden Murphy Wallace and Patrick Pierce. Ogden Murphy Wallace and Patrick Pierce are persons protected by RCW 424-510, and the trial court correctly granted Pierce and Ogden Murphy's motion for judgment on the pleadings pursuant to CR.
Isn't there a fundamental difference? As an investigator, you had a contractual duty to the state to report, to investigate and to report, and would probably have some duty of care to the state in how you discharge that. A whistleblower doesn't have an obligation or a duty or a contractual reason. It's purely voluntary, and that's the reason for some protection, isn't it?
I'd agree that under your two different examples, the motivation for making the communication might be different, but the plain text of the statute doesn't allow you to look into motivation when you're making the decision as to whether or not a person's protected by the statute.
It's not motivation, it's relationship. There's a contractual relationship and a contractual duty for the investigator to properly report. There's no contractual duty or statutory duty that's imposed on a whistleblower.
Correct, Your Honor, but a person...
You may be protected by the fact that you have a duty, and you may have a high standard of competence protecting you, but...
I just don't believe the statute allows you to look into the motivation. Segaline does address this, the Segaline decision, which is confined to the narrow issue of whether a government entity that doesn't have free speech rights is immune from protection for reporters making to another government entity. But if to the extent we follow the majority's opinion in Segaline, Ogden Murphy Wallace and Patrick Pierce do have free speech rights, both corporations and individuals do, and free speech rights also protect paid speech. There's nothing about speech being paid or speech being provided by a contract that removes protections. And I think the statute reflects that.
Let me ask you a question about Segalin. There's a concurrence by Justice Mattson. That concurrence relies on the Coburn case from Massachusetts, and counsel mentioned the Massachusetts statute, and I believe tied that concept of petitioning to the statutory notes in this case. Is there a difference of significance between the Massachusetts statute and our statute with respect to this question of who is a person?
Yes, Your Honor. In the Massachusetts case, the court there wasn't considering who a person was. The court was considering whether the speaker was exercising their personal right to petition. And RCW 424.510 makes no reference to a person's right to petition. It just says a person who's communicating a complaint or information. It doesn't say anything about why. And it's true that the legislative intent statement does reference the concept of a communication made to influence a government action. But those words in the intent statement, which you correctly noted, aren't reflected in the text of the statute. The statute's drafted more broadly than the intent statement. So to sum up, yes, there is a substantive difference.
What's different, though, about the Massachusetts statutory language that narrows the meaning of the term person?
I don't have the statute in front of me, but it specifically refers to a person exercising its right to petition. So those three words are the difference. And the court found that a person speaking had to be exercising their own right and acting in their own interest for their words to be, their speech to be protected. And the Washington court doesn't say that. And specifically, when the legislature removed the good faith requirement in 2002, they said, we don't care why you're talking. And if you look at the Bailey case and the Dalen case, it's clear that communication motivated by a pre-existing grudge is protected. That has nothing to do with a right to petition. That's just someone who is angry at the subject of their complaint. But we do not look into that because one of the legislature's policy goals here is to ensure early dismissal review. That's also in the intent statement. We want to make the statute easy to apply without discovery so cases can be dismissed early, and it's drafted broadly to accomplish that. And the Massachusetts statute just isn't that way.
Well, isn't the right to complain equivalent to the right to petition? I mean, that's...
Well, the statute doesn't limit itself specifically to complaints, Your Honor. It refers to a person communicating a complaint or information to any branch or agency of federal, state, or local government. Yeah, so if it were limited to complaint, I might be with you, but it has information. That's broad.
Now, if the state patrol was investigating instead of the law firm, would the state have liability for the wrongful conduct that's alleged here?
It would have liability. So, correct, Your Honor. But I would say that the AGO also did have liability here. I mean, the state isn't immunizing itself from communications that are not based upon.
So if the report was written by the state patrol as opposed to Ogden Murphy, then the state would have had liability if those statements were wrong.
That's correct, Your Honor.
So why shouldn't a contract agent have the same liability as the employee? Because the duty is flowing from the relationship with the state, not the relationship as a complainant third party.
I just don't believe there's any policy reason to exclude a contractor just by the mere fact that they're a contractor or that they receive payment from the government.
You had a duty to investigate, and therefore you had a standard of care.
That's correct, but we want the government to the extent the AGO felt that it needed an independent employment investigation to look into appellant's claims of sexual orientation discrimination, they should be incentivized to seek that assistance. Governments should be able to, should be incentivized to seek whatever information they want. Mm-hmm. And persons providing that information shouldn't be chilled from accepting those assignments by fear of liability from those who disagree.
Was there an agency relationship between the government and the investigator?
There is not, Your Honor. And if you look at Leishman, Ms. Appellant's complaint, it's on page 2 of the record, paragraph 8. You'll see that Mr. Appellant expressly pled that Ogden Murphy Wallace and Patrick Pierce were not, quote, officers, agents, employees, agents, or departments of the state of Washington.
Prior to that time, he had released agents of liability after the settlement agreement?
Correct, Your Honor. He brought employment claims against the AGO, and they were resolved by settlement. And he and his complaint wanted to make sure that Ogden Murphy and Patrick Pierce didn't seek the protection of that release. And so you didn't hear appellant argue directly that Segalin applies, because if Segalin applies and he is saying that Ogden Murphy Wallace and Pierce are a de facto government entity, then he's released his claims.
Well, why isn't Ogden an agent of the government? Why doesn't that dispose of the case?
I believe
just because he said they're a hired investigator isn't an agent doesn't make it so.
Well, just to be clear, Your Honor, this is an independent employment investigation sought by the AGO to get information from outside, and there's no attorney-client relationship there. And so the fact that he pled that in his complaint and is conceding it here today, I think that you should credit it. And to the extent you believe it's a legal inquiry that requires more discussion, I would say that nothing about Ogden Murphy's status here rises to that level. I could envision a case where a government contractor was so intertwined with a government entity, they essentially adopted a government function. The government staffed out one of its functions to a contractor.
So this wouldn't be a fallback argument for you, hypothetically. If you lost this case and went back, you wouldn't be arguing, well, in any event, we were released because we're an agent. You're saying you would never argue that?
I don't think I would say I wouldn't argue that, Your Honor, but I think that the correct view here is that Ogden Murphy was not an agent in the way this court should consider for the purposes of deciding whether or not Ogden Murphy was a government entity. And, Your Honor, I'll briefly address Mr. Leishman, appellant's claims about the nexus issue. If you look at through his complaint and the hypothetical facts that he's alleged, he's never made any claim that isn't fully based upon the report, and the Dang case makes it clear that it's not just the report, it's also the investigation that led to the report is protected. The trial court's decision should be affirmed.
Just a few points. Quickly, and firstly, the person argument, the motivation argument, it's a complete red herring. That the analysis in Segalin, it's not about what is a person, it's about what's the statute. My note said motivation versus status, but I will accept Judge Applewick's characterization, motivation versus relationship. Here the relationship was they were an independent contractor. They have legal duties. Those legal duties should be the same whether they're hired by Microsoft.
If they had a duty, it was a duty to investigate to an appropriate standard and to report accurately.
Exactly.
But that duty ran to the state, not to the people being investigated.
But as with appraisals and accountants, there are certain situations where that duty can run to someone else. But everyone has a duty to avoid committing fraud. And in this case, 6 weeks before they wrote the report, the quickest way of telling the facts are, I made a hash of my discrimination claim. Seeing me now, you don't realize this other than me fiddling with the thing. But unsurprisingly, I needed to hire a lawyer, and I did. But the state refused for 6 weeks to respond to my lawyer because they claimed they were investigating my sexual orientation complaint. That is the ultimate fundamental harm. I was interrogated for 90 minutes on the subject of my representation by an attorney at the direction of other attorneys. Those harms, you don't need to be an accountant or appraiser. for the law to say that doing that is wrong. And under Deng, something that is the report 6 weeks later is not the base, the base or foundation of my causes of action. The reason this case is important is not because the issues are particularly complex or my family was injured or this is a reprehensible business practice. It's because cases like this weaponize Section 510. To take someone who, in my situation, is complaining about a pervasive problem, and because of the threat of this kind of a attorney's fees award, just like Brenda Hill, I am being bankrupted by this. But they have insurance. There's a whole commercial regime out. There are 30-something cases that cite Section 510, but if you look out there and you search the court's database, you will find lots of briefs, many poorly written by pro ses. In fact, the analysis here was plagiarized from another brief by another firm in another case. It is abusive to ignore the Rule 12c standard, and it is a tragedy, a public policy tragedy, to use the Brenda Hill Section 510 to accomplish the very opposite of the legislator's intent. Thank you. I ask the court reverse.